some of the points that you raise in the power of photography. And it's really a history of photography, isn't it?
Well, it's in a way, it's a history of communications, a history of the way we became such a visual culture, which was certainly with a huge input from photography. But it took us through still photographs in line-cut reproduction in the middle 19th century, through moving photographs, which existed before there were movies, through slide lectures, which were extremely popular early in the century, through movies and the interrelationship of stills and movies, on to the picture magazine era, which starts in the United States in the mid-30s, into the television era, in which photographs have a different role.
Well, where did it all begin? Actually, I think the date, 1839.
Yeah, photography was invented in
1839. I think that's the date that stands out.
Yes, that's the date that Daguerre's invention was presented to the world. But the true influence of photography on specific events or on laws or on culture, I don't think begins for another 20 years, because the daguerreotype was a unique photograph. And only so many people could see it. How many people can see one photograph that cannot be reproduced? It's not until the late 1850s when you get mass reproduced photographs and when you get photographs reproduced in woodblock prints in newspapers that a photograph reaches a large enough audience to make a decisive difference. That's why the Civil War pictures are important. That's why the first portrait that Matthew Brady took of Abraham Lincoln is important. That's why photographs contribute to the creation of celebrity at that exact point. That's a kind of critical point in the distribution and perception of photographs.
Yeah, and it's interesting to note, although photographs could be reproduced, they could not be reproduced in printed material, such as newspapers. That's why you mentioned the woodblock.
Right, prints. The halftone, which is what we have in our newspapers today, it doesn't come into use really until about 1890. It's invented slightly before that. And in 1890, the first book with a lot of halftone prints comes in. That's Jacob Riis's How the Other Half Lives, which is about tenements and helps to lead to tenement reform law because people could see for the first time how the poor lived. And by the mid-1890s, when there were more halftones in newspapers, you got such events as the discovery of the X-ray, which went around the world not because it was discovered so much as because it could be made into a photograph of somebody's bones. Nobody had ever seen their own arm bones or their own hand bones before, and there they were in the newspaper. And it set the world on fire, and the man who discovered the X-ray, Conrad Röntgen, in Germany, said he was rather upset about it, that the photographs were simply to prove a point, and they had become more important than the discovery itself. There are those who say that photography doesn't really begin as we know it until the halftone comes in, because that's when mass reproduction comes in. The rotary press, the rotogravure in the newspapers, which is really big by the second decade of this century, the illustrated magazine, the illustrated newspaper, those owe almost everything to the halftone print.
Yeah, I bought a beautiful travel book, a Victorian-era travel book published in 1888. I found it at the Strand for $5. Beautiful book, great illustrations.
Lucky
gives the steamship schedules and the railroad schedules and everything. And lots of advertisements. Mm-hmm. But I noticed the photo, and it's filled with photographs, all glued into the
pages.
That's
right. That was the only way you could do it. That's why
Must have been a hand job to do that.
That's right, and it was very expensive because you could not print the photograph at the same time you could print the text. There are lots of pictures at that time with tipped-in photographs, but of course they're more expensive because of the labor that's involved. It was this spectacular invention that would put the reproduction on the rotary press that makes the simultaneous printing of pictures and text so important. There were illustrated papers much earlier than this. The first illustrated paper in the world, really, is in 1842, the London Illustrated News, and that has line cuts in it, and many of the line cuts are after photographs. And the photograph, which was so newly invented in 1839, seemed to people to be truth and reality. They knew that you couldn't muck around with a photograph the way you can with a drawing. So if you printed underneath this picture, this line cut picture, after a photograph by Matthew Brady, then people thought you were telling the truth, We don't think that so much anymore. People tend to think, to realize that photographs can lie, but in those days, that wasn't the case. Even before you could really reproduce the photograph, if you said it was after a photograph, that was okay. Now, today we have an extra problem with that, you know, with the new digitization, with the potential for putting a photograph onto a computer and fiddling with it, fiddling with the pixels, so that you can take out a gun or put in an extra person with great ease, and no one will ever know the difference. There is another issue of whether you're going to believe a photograph, and we may have to label photographs again after an actual photograph that has not been tampered with, or something odd like that, for people to believe them as they used to.
There ought to be a law.
I think there are going to be new court cases and a new set of laws and certainly new ethical considerations because of these new inventions.
I don't know about the laws. You're really potentially damaging the freedom to express yourself in photography by doing certain things. For example, I don't know that there's any law. We're making a tape right now. But there's no law that says I can't alter this tape in a variety of ways.
That's true.
Except for pure ethics and the fact that we're not allowed to do it here. But I know it's been done.
Well, but there will always be laws that will still govern that. I mean, you could make a tape that was libelous, and you could be sued for libel for having doctored that tape. You know, you could invent something on the tape that was libelous. It would still fit under the old law. No, I think you're right. It's going to be an ethical consideration. We're going to have to decide whether the news photograph can be tampered with in the same degree that a fiction photograph or an art photograph can be tampered with. News has always been thought to deliver the goods, and now it's you're quite capable of rearranging it so that it doesn't.
Well, back to some of the historical milestones in photography, the stereograph, tell me about that.
Well, the stereograph also comes in the 1850s, and what was extraordinary about that, of course, was its extreme three-dimensionality. It looked like you were really seeing what was going on, and they were very inexpensive. Oliver Wendell Holmes wrote about them, about how wonderful they were, and what happens with the stereograph is that almost everybody in the middle class had a viewer and had a certain number of glass stereograph plates out in the parlor. They had entertained friends with it. They sat around with their families and looked at pictures of the West or whatever it was. And I think that is the precursor of television, because everybody sat around at the same time and saw the same scene. They just saw it serially, one after the other, instead of at the same time. It was a family entertainment center with a visual image in it, so that we were becoming accustomed way back in the 1850s to getting together to watch a photographic representation of what had been going on.
1873, the running horse.
It's a little later. I think it's 1878. Yes, Edward Muybridge rigged up a set of cameras that were fast enough to stop a horse in motion, and he proved that the horse did indeed have all four legs off the ground, as people had suspected that the horse did. But people had always thought that the horse had the legs extended fore and aft like a rocking horse, and Muybridge proved that they were tucked up under his belly. That meant that something like 20 centuries of art had been thrown out the drain. Way back in Greek and Roman times, they had horses running in this peculiar way that they couldn't have. If a horse had run with its legs out fore and aft, it would have fallen flat on its belly. So that artists all changed. Degas copied Muybridge's photographs. Thomas Aikens copied Muybridge's photographs. But it was very upsetting to people because the eye can't see as fast as the camera shutter can close. So people began looking at these pictures and saying, that doesn't look like the way I see the horse run. And there was a big debate among artists about whether they should depict it the way it was, truthfully, or the way it looked to the eye. It really raised the question of the truthfulness of representation. Should it be scientific, or should it be perceptual?
Well, the running horse was a precursor to the time study photography by Frank Gilbreth.
Yes, it certainly was. Gilbreth knew some of those studies, particularly by a Frenchman named Marais, when Gilbreth was a scientific manager and he was brought in to teach people how to work faster. He was brought in by management to make workers work up to snuff. What he did was to take consecutive photographs of the best workers. So later he took movies and slowed them down to single frames, and to then teach the other workers to imitate those motions. It was a kind of manual slavery in a way, because some people didn't have the same hand motions. Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times later in 1930s is complaining about the kind of speed-up this involves. He eventually is made into a machine because he's asked to speed up to somebody else's level continually. And Gilbreth, however, contributed a great deal. He made photographs of wounded soldiers in rehabilitation in World War I and helped teach rehabilitative techniques to them. But the unions were extraordinarily upset by this kind of photographic tyranny, that everybody should be turned into a machine performing the exact same motions as everybody else.
The photograph and crime detection, that had a lot of good ideas at the beginning, didn't quite work out the way a lot of people expected it to, did it?
As early as 1839, the year that the photograph was invented, the police in Europe were taking mugshots of criminals. And that was done continually throughout the 19th century, but it was very hard to identify by a mugshot because there were no standards. The police had no photo labs. They sent them out to different studios, and studios took them different ways, three-quarter view, full face, profile, who knew? Therefore, they were all different. And it was not till the 1870s that a man named Bertillon in France standardized that, said you had to take a full face, you had to take a profile. And he also began to classify criminals by their noses, eyes, and mouths, so you could retrieve them in the file. Small mouth, you look it up. Big nose, you look it up. And you put that together because people changed their appearances, shaved their beards, cut their hair, grew it, whatever, whatever. It was very useful once it got standardized for about 25 years, and then the fingerprint came in, and that was really something you couldn't fake. You couldn't grow hair over it. You couldn't clip it. And it tended to a degree to displace the photograph, but we still have wanted posters, and there are a couple of television programs that have brought in a lot of criminals by displaying their face and having people call up and say, I've seen that guy.
Now, all through the power of photography, you talk about war photography, and it's interesting to note that while the Civil War was extensively photographed, there were really no action scenes, were there? No battles?
No, the camera was too slow to do action scenes during the Civil War. That doesn't really happen until some good time later. And therefore, the illustrators carried on the tradition of action scenes, and they often faked them up a little bit, made them look like paintings. I believe that people's ideas of what war was like must have changed during the Civil War simply from seeing pictures of the dead, which were reproduced. Most of the Civil War photographs are of fields where somebody died, fields of battle, houses where a major engagement took place, pictures of the soldiers themselves, and those terrifying pictures of dead soldiers, which no one had ever seen before in history. That war, which was extensively reported and extensively photographed and extensively illustrated by sketch artists, I think is the beginning of reported news in the United States, news that is reported as it goes on. Do you know, you could get reports of back in as little as 24 hours from that war. You could get photographs into a gallery within a month. It's unheard of that that speed could have happened at that time. And you could have gotten photographs that were available to be sent to you through the mail within 2 months. That sounds like a lot of time to us with our satellite dishes. But it was extraordinarily fast then. It had never happened before. So people got accustomed to having some nearly contemporary report of what was going on, partially because of the photographs of that war.
Now, the First World War, a little different. You point out there was very heavy censorship.
At one point during the First World War on the European front, a civilian photographer was not allowed on the field of battle under pain of death, which is a pretty good way to keep a photographer off. Eventually, the Germans were making so much hay with their propaganda that the Allies decided they had better bring photographers along. There were journalists. There's a famous photojournalist named Jimmy Hare who was there to take photographs, but he said that he thought that the War Office thought its biggest enemies were the photographers and not the opposing army.
They're still saying that.
Yes, particularly in the last war, they're still saying that. And there were very few images that came out of that war of any of the terrors of war. The censorship was so strong that the pictures of trench warfare and mass death and many of the horrors that occurred there did not come out until long after the war. And in fact, I think that led to a lot of disillusionment with the press and the government that they had withheld this information. And, as you point out, we are back in that situation. Having had so many horror pictures from Vietnam, the military has cracked down, not just in the Gulf War, but prior to that in Panama and Grenada. These have been very clean wars pictorially because the photographers were kept off the field or the horrifying information was withheld by the censors.
I inherited a whole bunch of photographs that my grandfather acquired. He was a captain in the First World War. And the style of photography, well, they were cards that you could mail. I think you addressed that in the book. They were very popular in the late 19th century, early 20th century. They actually were postcards. And some of them looked like they were pictures taken by the brigade photographer, in fact, with a postcard style on the back, where he could write on it and then mail it back to the folks in Kansas. And I have dozens of these photographs, some of him with his men, some of the German villages where he stayed, with arrows pointing out where his office was and this sort of thing. Some shots of him with civilians, and some were generic, and they would just show rubble, burned-out towns, crosses along the side of the road where there were graves. But it was interesting to note that you never saw any real carnage. I mean, you could see a bombed-out church, but never any bodies. He himself was gassed and lost a lung and was out of action for a long time before he went back. And he describes in his postcards, because they're very detailed, their annotations are very detailed about the deaths. His own commanding officer was killed during the war, for example. He was gassed. But the photographs don't show any of that. It struck me that they were cleaned up a little bit for home consumption.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You've got an amazing history if you've got his writings with it as well.
I do. It's a wonderful story. And he was a school teacher, and he wrote with this beautiful hand. And his English, his grammar, wonderful. He could have been a writer, perhaps, instead of a school teacher and later a postal employee. But it was just interesting. The photo, I wish I had brought them to you just so
I'd
you could
see
them.
That is the nature of those photographs. Yeah. You're quite right. They are perfectly willing to show you that there was bomb damage, particularly if
their side.
Yes, yes, of course.
The other side.
That's right. Yes, but dead bodies were verboten. In World War II, you know, that was the case as well for a long time. You could show dead Japanese and dead Germans to the American public, but you could not show a dead American until September of 1943. They thought it would ruin morale to see that our GIs were dying, which of course they were. And then finally in the spring of 43, when morale here was bad on other levels, people were complaining about rationing. They were grumbling about a lot of the hardships that they were suffering back home. The administration decided that that was because they had got this too clean picture of war. They didn't think enough bad things were happening. And it was decided in high administration councils with Franklin Roosevelt's agreement that it was time to allow the publication of pictures of dead Americans. So the first major instance of that was in September of 1943, when Life magazine published a picture by George Strock of three dead Americans on Buna Beach. And they wrote a whole page about this, since it was the first time this had been allowed. And that picture, which was very carefully posed, the men were lying face down on the beach, you couldn't identify anybody, and it wasn't posed, but composed. And it was rather elegiac and lyrical, and it had this wonderful text with it that said, "Here you see a little piece of America." That picture was used on war bond posters immediately, and the war bond drive contributions went up. The administration seems to have been right that understanding the cost to people of their sons and their husbands and their fathers did make a difference to Americans, that keeping all that horror out of their lives was not the best way to go about it. After that, of course, we had a lot of pictures of dead Americans, although they were again, and wounded Americans, they were again careful about identification in those instances, not wishing to harm the family, which you can understand. But even earlier than that, we'd had horror pictures of dead GIs, frozen, dead Germans, frozen in the snow in Finland, for instance, or that terrible picture of the Japanese who had been burned in a foxhole, I think it was, and his skull is screaming. You could never publish that of Americans. Opponents can meet terrible deaths, but Americans cannot.
The photograph and the political figure, you talk a lot about that. I guess one of the first major political photographs was of Lincoln.
Yes, I think that's the first photograph ever to have influenced an American election. That was Brady's 1860 photograph of Lincoln, the beardless Lincoln, before that little girl told him he'd look better with a beard. It was taken when he was campaigning for the Republican nomination, and he made a very famous speech the same night, which in New York, which garnered him huge praise. One of the papers said he was the greatest man since St. Paul, which ain't bad. So naturally, people wanted to know what he looked like. And you have to remember, people did not know what people looked like in 1860. There weren't magazines with people's photographs in them. So in the Northeast, he was almost unknown. And again, this was at a moment when you could mass reproduce photographs. You could reproduce a little photograph which sold for $2 or $3 a dozen. And you could produce them in the tens of thousands. And you could copy them in lithographs. It was also the first year of the photographic campaign button, so that you could wear a photograph of Lincoln on your lapel. And it was particularly important to know what Lincoln looked like. And Brady made him look very good, made him look like a wise man and a statesman and a president, because he was reputed to be so homely. There was one political commentator at the time who said that Mr. Lincoln has most unwarrantably abused the privilege all politicians have of being ugly. So when Brady made him look better than that, it was very useful for his reputation. It was also useful because once Lincoln won the Republican nomination, he never again made a campaign speech. It was thought vulgar in those days to want the presidency so badly that you go out and talk about it. He stayed at home, and his picture went forth to do his campaigning for him. So that I think that picture did have an influence on an American election, and God knows we've had pictures that had an influence on elections since then.
Well, thank God for Matthew Brady's photograph. I can't imagine Lincoln looking anything other than Lincoln. Can you? I mean, he looks just right.
Yes, he does. It's quite so. And he took something like 17 or 34 more pictures of Lincoln after that. And one of them became even more widely distributed. He took one of his operatives took a picture in 1864 during the Civil War, which was reproduced already in 1866 on a stamp, was reproduced in 1923 on a 3-cent stamp, and is the picture still, the basis of the picture still on the $5 bill.
Now, the photograph as a social instrument, you referred to Jacob Riis a few minutes ago. I guess that was the first major use of a photograph to influence social policy, huh?
Yes, but Riis, when he began doing his reporting in the late 1880s, said that he could use all the words he wanted, but it didn't make the impression, and he needed a visual stimulus. He said, "I could have used drawings, but I can't draw. I never could draw." And he knew he couldn't photograph in these dark tenements, and he suddenly read in the paper one day that a German had invented a flash powder. It was a very dangerous magnesium powder that you set fire to. It made a big explosion. Twice Riis set his own house on fire with it, but it could photograph in the dark. And when he began reporting on the poor at that time, the social reform movement was coming up in America. Prior to that time, it was thought to be tacky to show pictures of the poor Why would you want to hang your dirty linen in public? But about 1890, as Hull House and Jane Addams were coming along, there was a new interest in the poor, and suddenly we had not prettified drawings of them, but rather raw pictures of people in five-cent-a-night lodgings and dank basement apartment buildings. And Reese was a newspaper reporter. He got his paper to reproduce some of these pictures. He wrote this book, which had the first extensive halftones in it. He went out and lectured all over America with very dramatic slide lectures with music. And one time he showed a picture of a little boy sleeping on the street. And a chorus offstage sang, "Where is my wandering boy tonight?" So he really wrung the audience's heart. And in fact, at his slide lectures, people are said to have fainted and screamed to see what was on the screen. You have to remember how new photography was, how new this subject was. People had never seen how the poor lived. And he is said to be, Reese is said to be, the major reformer of the time, because he could harness the newspaper reports and the photographs and the speaking and the books all to this one cause.
By the 30s, photography wasn't so new, but some major photographs of the migrants certainly had a social impact, didn't they?
Yes, they really did. Clearest evidence is contained in some photographs that Dorothea Lange took in the winter of 1934-35. A man named Paul Schuster Taylor, who later married Dorothea Lange, was asked to help California draw up a plan for those thousands of Okies that were streaming into California during the Dust Bowl. And he realized he would need very good evidence, and he thought he needed a photographer, and they didn't want to hire a photographer. Who needs photographers? And he got Dorothea Lange onto the payroll by disguising her as a typist. And she went out and took pictures of how the migrants were living in these terrible unsanitary camps. They put those pictures into a report to go to Washington. They put those pictures into an auxiliary report that they gave to one of the federal relief administrators. And his board, they put them into a spiral-bound notebook so you could take them out very easily. When his board passed them around, they tore out the pictures and passed those around to everybody. And they voted $20,000 to his plan, which was to build better camps for the migrants. That's the first federally funded housing in America. And it was partially brought about because of the power of those photographs.
And there was one particular photograph, the migrant mother, that became an icon. Perhaps we ought to discuss photographs as icons.
Well, I think there are a number of photographs that have really gotten lodged into our minds and that are part of the common culture. I think all of us know the raising of the flag at Iwo Jima. All of us know the picture of the atom bomb. Almost everybody knows this picture of the migrant mother with her hand to her mouth and the sleeping baby and the two children behind her shoulders. They are part of what unifies the American culture or what unifies the world culture in these days. That has a lot to do with Marshall McLuhan's Global Village, where everybody has, to some degree, the same knowledge. And some of that same knowledge, a lot of it, is in pictures. Those pictures are very forceful, and when a generation comes up that no longer remembers Migrant Mother or no longer remembers Joe Rosenthal, Joe Rosenthal's picture of Iwo Jima, we will not be in the same culture, because a culture has to have a common fund of memories to draw on, a common set of symbols, a common set of images to hold together. And photographs are to us what myths were to previous ages. You know, we don't have an Athena, we don't have a Thor. What we have are these emblems. We don't even have public monuments so much anymore that are representative. It used to be that your general was commemorated with a bronze statue astride a horse in a square. Now we have got a picture of General MacArthur wading ashore, you know, when he returned to the Philippines. And everybody has that little monument someplace in memory instead of having it out on the public square the way it used to be.
The sensibility of photography seems to merge with other sensibilities with regard to photography. For example, it's hard to separate a dramatic news photo from a photo that well, the raising the flag in Iwo Jima was a news photo, and
as
yet it became an icon. But you have other examples, too, that are dramatic news photographs, but not necessarily icons. The photograph of the monk in Indochina immersing himself in gasoline and burning himself, and the picture of a Viet Cong being shot with a pistol, and I mean, the dramatic photograph of the Hindenburg exploding. I guess for the first time, though, action shots began to develop in the 30s. I mean, real action shots that could be easily reproduced and disseminated around the world.
Well, that has to do largely with the invention of the 35-millimeter camera, which is the first one, is marketed in 1925, and then by 1931, 32, numbers of photographers picked them up. You got faster film, you could get fast action shots, you could get them in available light, you could get them on the scene. And I think that has been the progress of visual communications via photographic media, that they got faster and faster, more and more immediate, more and more on the scene, which is one of the reasons that still photography has been partially displaced by television, because it takes you right to the scene. And one of the reasons that during the Gulf War, the audience for CNN went up so far, because they were right there. In fact, they were the only people in Baghdad. And so if you watch the news photography, if you watch it go from the Civil War pictures, the field where General so-and-so died, which is nothing but a bare field, but must have been very meaningful to people then, and you watch it go up through staged photographs, for instance, of the sinking of the Maine in the Spanish-American War, because nobody happens to have been there. They staged it in a bathtub. And you go up to the 30s, where you could find, we go through Jacob Riis, who is managing to catch people in the dark, not so very active, but they're in the dark. He would burst into a room firing his magnesium. People would jump out of windows. They were so terrified they thought it was an attack. But then in the 1930s, you get this little fast camera that you can carry with you. You don't need a tripod. You don't need a lot of glass plates with you. You can just take it with you into the action. So you are getting people witnessing the flag as it's going up, the shells as they are bursting, the tank as it's coming over the ridge. And that has been the allure of news. That has been the allure of the photograph, that you are present there even though you are removed in some way. During that war, the British, for instance, provided their newsmen with electronic equipment in the field so that they could phone back immediately and they could electronically send photographs back. Their coverage was much better than ours, by and large, because nobody was out there, because we wouldn't permit them to be out there. And, of course, CNN was in place to do that broadcasting from the Middle East.
Let's go back a little bit. Sex in the photograph. We have Gable without an undershirt, Gable with an undershirt. We have Betty Grable looking over her shoulder, Marilyn Monroe with her skirt up in the air. The photograph has really been beneficial in terms of letting us know what other people look like, especially good-looking ones.
Well, even not so good-looking ones, it's true.
True.
I guess I think that the photograph was really instrumental in the foundation of celebrity. A distinction has been made between fame, which is a reputation you gain for a solid achievement, and celebrity, which is the fame of being famous. Madonna is a prime celebrity because she's an image in some way, and everybody knows her image, even if they haven't caught her act, let us say. But again, around the late 1850s, when it became possible to mass reproduce photographs of people, there was a little photograph called the carte de visite, which was the size of a calling card. And it was invented in the 50s, and by 1860, there were photo albums. There had never been albums before. So you could collect pictures of famous actors and famous actresses and politicians and queens and put them in your album and have them on your parlor table. I figure that photography made it possible for you to have a representative in your home of people who would not have accepted your invitation had you extended it. And everybody could get pictures of people that they were interested in, which certainly increased the number of people who were interested in having their photograph taken. Actresses caught on very fast. Sarah Bernhardt said that if you had piled one on top of the other, all the photographs that had ever been taken of her, you'd have reached the top of the Eiffel Tower. And it went on certainly into the movie era. As soon as there were stars in movies, which doesn't happen until 1910 when screen credits come in, there are fan magazines. And fan magazines publish still photographs of actors, and they even by the mid-second decade were handing out still photographs as prizes for taking out a subscription to the magazine. By 1915, Mary Pickford signs a $1 million contract to lend her face to some sort of a cold cream ad, so that the fame of the movies is enhanced by the fame of the photograph, and all of it enhances the fame of the stars. What happens with Clark Gable is a rather amusing story. In 1934, when he made It Happen One Night, in the famous motel scene where he undresses, where he gives Claudette Colbert a lesson in how a gent takes off his clothes, and says he takes off his jacket, then his tie, then his shirt. When he took off his shirt, he was not wearing an undershirt. All men at that time in America wore undershirts. It was just the fashion. But when they realized that this wonderful, handsome star didn't wear an undershirt, they stopped. And it is said that the undershirt sales for that year went down 75%. This was the Depression, and that was a total disaster. And the underwear manufacturers went to Hollywood and said, "We're bankrupt, you've got to do something for us." And after a couple of years, Hollywood did make another movie called Idiot's Delight with Clark Gable and Norma Shearer, in which he took off his shirt again and was revealed to be Wonder of Wonders wearing an undershirt. I don't know how much that increased the business, but it did help. Fan pictures of stars began to be put up in dormitories in the 1930s, you know, that whole teenage craze for rock stars, it really begins back then. And Betty Grable, who'd been in a lot of co-ed movies, had a kind of head start on the whole thing when she became the chief pinup of World War II. She was out ahead of Dorothy L'Amour and ahead of Rita Hayworth. She was the one that 50,000 soldiers a month supposedly wrote for. And her pinup in that bathing suit, looking back over her shoulder, is supposed to have gotten associated with the war effort.
I never found that photograph particularly sexy, though.
Well, but you see, it's a different time. In those days, the books for self-improvement for women told women that legs were the first thing that men looked at. It wasn't until after the war that the bosom became primary. During that time, it was still legs. And she was the highest-paid star in Hollywood. So that made a great deal of difference. And it was an unusual pose, I think. You know, Betty Grable had a very special appeal. She had a kind of a working man appeal. The Harvard Lampoon, or whatever it was, voted her the worst actress of the year. Upper-class people never thought she was so fabulous, but she had a mass appeal across America. And so there she was, looking absolutely perfect in her Betty Grable way, you know, with her little ankle bracelet on and her white bathing suit and her perfectly upswept curls, looking back in a kind of come-hither way over her shoulder. She had what was for the time a very sexy and still wholesome look. She was the girl next door. She was the kind of June Allison of singers and dancers, you know. There were stories in the movie magazines about GIs who died clutching her photograph. It was reported that Germans and Japanese had been
captured. Purely coincidental.
Well, I don't know. There are also tales of people writing her and saying things like, there we were in those dirty trenches with the bombs bursting all around us, sick, tired, scared, and suddenly someone would pull your picture out of his wallet, and then we'd know what we were fighting for.
Well, I guess it's better than Bob Hope. Picture Bob Hope.
Well, you know, the Army made it, the Air Force made it official with Betty Grable. They took that pinup, they blew it up to an enormous size, they lined it off vertical and horizontal lines, and they used it to teach flyers how to navigate.
Well, Vicki, we're almost out of time. Just one question or two questions left. You don't really differentiate too much between the still photograph and the movie camera, do you?
Oh, sure. There's a huge difference. But after all, the movie camera is a derivative of the still camera. It couldn't have existed before there were still photographs. But the what interests me is the interplay between the two of them, the way the fan magazine and the still on the marquee, you know, outside the movie, and the fan picture that's sent out by the thousands and thousands, the way those play off against the film image of the person. I mean, after all, Demi Moore gets on the cover of Vanity Fair. That's a still shot, but it presumably helps her career in movies. These things depend upon one another. I mean, you're not in a movie all the time. If you want to keep an image, if you want to keep Farrah Fawcett in a bathing suit on your wall, you've got to have a still image. We don't usually have movies flickering all the time on our walls.
Well, the videotape camera, the video camera, do you think that will ever replace film as we know it? I think more people probably use... I don't think people take home movies the way they used to.
No, I don't either.
35mm cameras, but...
No, people, if they have them, use video cams, but I'm told that people use them for a year and then stop using them like all new toys. They tend to go.
But it's a new dimension in terms of photography, though, isn't it?
Well, yes, and as it gets better and better, a lot of movie makers won't use tape, as you know, because they don't think the resolution is as good. But as the editing gets simpler...
It is sharper, though.
Well, there's some debate among movie makers.
You can see it on television. You can see I used to work with film and with videotape when I was in television in Baltimore, and you could see the difference. Videotape is always sharper than film, but film seemed to have more nuances.
Yes,
videotape,
I think that's fair, actually.
Was brighter and cleaner,
I think that's fair.
But you could do less with regard to shadows and depth and this sort of thing with it. But it was certainly clearer.
Well, I there are a lot of filmmakers who won't use it still. I mean, I think it's, you know...
Where would you play it back? I mean, there are no theaters equipped to show giant videotapes, are there?
Give them time.
So where are we headed? What's going to happen to photography in the future?
I don't know the answer to that. I don't think photography will ever, well, I can't say ever, but in the near future, there's no question that we're going to need photography still. But I think that what has already happened, it's been happening since the 70s, is that in terms of the news, photography has been pushed to a side. It is still massively important, but the primary source of news is now the most immediate, which is television. If you heard that there was a great crisis of some sort, another assassination, you wouldn't wait till the paper came out next morning. You'd turn to your television. Still, if you wanted to see it in some way that you could remember it, since still photographs are much more readily remembered than moving images are, you would turn to the newspaper or to the magazines, and you could clip that, and you could keep that, which you can't do so readily with a tape. There are areas in which the still photograph is still primary, among other places, in the Third World, which is 10, 15 years behind us in television. If you remember... A couple of years ago, there was a guy in Kuwait who was tried for wearing a T-shirt with a picture of Saddam Hussein on it. That was a photographic image of Hussein, and he was given 15 years in prison for wearing it. So the photograph is still a pretty powerful instrument. In 1989, there were some demonstrators in Tiananmen Square who defaced a portrait of Chairman Mao. They were turned in by the students themselves. They were tried after the revolution was put down. One of them was given a 3-year jail sentence. One of them was given a 6-year jail sentence, and the leader was given a sentence for life. Again, that photograph has been really massively important, or it wouldn't have cost somebody a life in jail. And there are areas in our world, in whatever, there is no third world anymore, but whatever world we're in, that still photography is still very important. I can think of several instances in which still photographs, rather than TV reports or movies, have made a difference on the environment, have made a difference in voting patterns, have made a difference in legislation. But ordinarily, that happens on a more local level, in an area, in a state, rather than nationwide or worldwide, as the impact, let us say, of the picture of General Luan executing a suspect on the street of Saigon, or the picture of the raising of the flag of Iwo Jima, or the picture of the Hindenburg explosion. Those were worldwide in their impact. Recently, the photographs that have had the most impact seem to have done so on a rather more local level.
Well, the power of photography is certainly helpful in illuminating a book, Vicki Goldberg. Thank you very much.
Thank you.